The House now comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of the Leader of the Opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Prime Minister, does she stand by all her government's statements and actions?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes, particularly in regard to the way this government has responded promptly to the challenges presented through COVID-19, whether it's the work that's going through the House today to give roughly $3 billion worth of tax refunds back to business, particularly small businesses, to support them, or it's our mental health response, where we've supported and funded apps and other mechanisms like telehealth services that are available through isolation. We have looked at and responded quickly to every element of pain that COVID-19 has caused New Zealand.
Does she accept that every day New Zealand remains in level 3 means more businesses failing and more jobs lost?
Mr. Speaker, I accept that any day that we move prematurely into a different alert level poses a risk to New Zealand's economy and a risk to New Zealanders' health. If we move too soon, and this is supported by Treasury, if we move too soon, Mr. Speaker, we risk yo-yoing between levels, and that would be damaging to our economy and to our people. I had a conversation just today with Prime Minister Scott Morrison. We talked about that exact thing, the need for all of us to move with caution.
Well, does she agree with Prime Minister Scott Morrison, who in the last 24 hours has stated that he sees the New Zealand approach as involving, quote, much more extreme economic measures, and that's why he's not going to do that?
Mr. Speaker, two points to make. Actually, where we are now, there are some real similarities in the levels that we are at now. Second point, New Zealand has always responded to what is happening here with our population and our cases, and that hasn't been comparable at those times with Australia. And thirdly, Prime Minister Morrison often has had to give those responses because people have compared the results in New Zealand and Australia, often favourably around the approach that New Zealand has taken.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
I ask the Prime Minister, as a matter of policy formation, what intellectual credibility would she give to the view that you can smash the curve whilst leaving businesses unaffected?
Mr. Speaker, I think you can see around the world there are economic impacts to successfully taking
order
on COVID-19.
Order. Order. No, that the Right Honourable Gentleman knows that that expression should not be levelled at any other member. He will withdraw and apologise.
I withdraw and apologise.
Speaker, we can see around the world there are economic consequences to an effective response to COVID-19, but there are also economic consequences if you don't get it right. You stay in lockdown for longer, the impact on business and jobs is much harsher. Our approach has always been go hard, good, go early, get it right the first time. The other thing that, Mr. Speaker, I've seen the commentary from the likes of Sir Peter Gluckman at Select Committee today. He shared the exact same cautious approach that we have been taking. No one wants to risk the loss, the gains that we have made. No one wants a second wave of infection.
Does she agree that New Zealand has taken a more extreme approach economically than Australia?
Mr. Speaker, again, I have challenged the characterisation that the members made at different times of Australia and New Zealand in the House. But, Mr. Speaker, I've also pointed out that we have had a different experience of COVID-19 in New Zealand and we have a different population. I would have thought the member would like us to follow our own path on behalf of our own people rather than just replicating what others have done, because it hasn't necessarily been a successful template in all parts
order,
of the world.
Order. She's the cat's mother.
Well, I'm not going to say yes, because she's a woman.
Why doesn't Cabinet continuously review the need to remain in level 3 instead of arbitrarily waiting 2 weeks to make the decision?
Mr. Speaker, as epidemiologists and scientists and health professionals have continually told us, There are cycles of infection, that if you don't allow a cycle of infection, then you're less likely to see whether or not you still have transmission of COVID-19 and whether or not we can safely move. Mr. Speaker, I do want to give some caution to the member opposite. He was the one that, when we went into lockdown level 4, agreed that we would not want to move at a pace that would mean that we would damage New Zealand's health and economy. He appears now to be advocating that we move with haste. No one in the world at the moment is risking their economy or health by moving more rapidly than the science or the evidence or the officials suggest.
What does she say to the 160 workers at Farmers who today have been made redundant because her government has shut their stores down for at least 7 weeks?
Mr. Speaker, I would say to any worker who is affected currently by COVID-19 that first, we've put in place $10 billion worth of support so far to try and keep those workers in their jobs. Secondly, the approach we've taken has always been to speed up the opportunity for us to reopen the economy as soon as possible. But the third point is I will not risk their health, I will not risk their family's health by moving before we are sure that we can confidently do so.
What does she say to the Managing Director of Farmers, David Norman, who says the longer the New Zealand stores are locked down, the more job losses there will be?
Mr. Speaker, all the way along we have known and appreciated the huge impact of a response, an effective response to COVID-19. That's why we've never wanted to be in lockdown longer than we needed to. It's also why we put in place a 12-week wage subsidy that is worth over $10 billion to support employers, large and small, to keep their employees connected to their work. And our hope is, Mr. Speaker, that if we continue to see success, that we will be able to move through the alert levels and get people back into work. 75% of economic activity has returned now, though.
David Seymour.
Can the Prime Minister tell the House succinctly how her government will balance health and economic considerations in the decision to move from level 3 to level 2 and when?
Speaker, the economic goal has to be reducing the amount of time spent in the most restricted levels as possible. The best way to do that is ensure that you have confidence in your health response, that you do not have community transmission, and that you do not risk yo-yoing back from one level to another. Treasury scenarios demonstrate to us the economic impact of doing that, which is why they supported the decision that we made to have an extra few days at level 4, as we did, to try and lock in the gains that we had made.
Highly misleading to say that 75% of economic activity is up and running when even Treasury acknowledges that's not so. It's theoretical, and the real reality of that productively will be much lower.
Speaker, that's Treasury's estimate. If you wish to challenge that, I suggest you do that directly with Treasury.
Why does she think the farmers' stores in Australia are able to remain open for longer and will be able to open again this week, meaning there will be fewer job losses in Australia than New Zealand?
Speaker, I do think it's too soon to make any comparisons around the relative impact of the difference, indeed, state approaches, let alone approach of Australia versus New Zealand as a whole. Mr. Speaker, I think we should allow New Zealand and Australia to let this run its course, see then the full economic and health impacts. But I don't apologise for taking an approach that's specific to New Zealand, to the cases we had here, and to our own population.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
In light of that last supplementary question, can the Prime Minister confirm reports in the Australian media that as at the 17th of April, only an extra 1.7% of workers had gone on to New Zealand's job seeker benefit, while in Australia the number was 3.8%?
Mr. Speaker, I can confirm that, which is why I do believe it's important that we allow a bit more time before we start making any crude comparisons like that. And I don't think it's helpful necessarily for the member opposite to be talking down the work that we are all doing to try and gear ourselves back up as quickly and safely as possible.
What does she say to the man from Lower Hutt who messaged me last night saying, quote, I'm now on the wage subsidy, which came to $420 in the hand a week. We have a mortgage and six children. I was earning over $50K in an industry which I've been in for 25 years. Tonight we fed our children a pumpkin for dinner, power bill, mortgage, insurance, school fees, and it's gone. Tomorrow we're having porridge for dinner. When can we get back to level two so we can get back to earning our salaries?
The Speaker, obviously that is an employee who very unfortunately is either working in retail or hospitality, areas where there is high risk still. What we want to do is make sure that when we're in a position to open up those parts of the economy, that we can do it for good and that we don't keep yo-yoing between the different levels. Mr. Speaker, if that is an individual where we can provide any additional support through our social services, I would really encourage him to make sure that they are in touch with their relevant MP to make sure that they are getting all that they are entitled to.
Question number two, Kiritapu Allen.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Education. What steps is the government taking to bring forward education infrastructure projects to help stimulate regional economies?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, today the government announced upgrades for a further 600 small or remote state schools and kura. This is an additional $160 million property improvement program that will begin rolling out this year. The upgrades include the installation of LED lights, acoustic panelling, ceiling insulation and other things in our small and remote schools. We want students to be learning in warm classrooms. We want teachers to have workplaces where the noise levels are more controllable. And we want schools to be able to save on their power bill so that they can invest in learning. So this initiative is part of the government's program to bring forward infrastructure projects to create and support jobs for businesses and reboot our local economies. The list of schools who will benefit from the program will be announced by the Ministry of Education on their website this week, and every school on the list will also be contacted.
Marima Davidson.
How many schools will benefit from the first wave of Sustainability Fund?
Mr. Speaker, very good news. Today the government has announced that 53 schools have been successful in the first wave of the Sustainability Fund, with $2.5 million being spent on projects that will help them save money and reduce emissions. Nearly half of the 53 approved applications were for solar panels on schools. Other projects include things like rainwater collection, water conservation initiatives, and different ways to compost and recycle. The Sustainability Fund is open again for a second round of applications. It will open again for a second round of applications on the 22nd of June, where a further $2.5 million will be allocated to further sustainability projects in schools.
What construction is resuming in schools across the country over the next few days?
Mr. Speaker, now that we're alert level three, construction work will be restarting this week at almost 250 schools around the country. As well as this, construction will start on another $100 million worth of school property projects. These include things like the major redevelopment to address weather tightness and other building issues at Flaxmere College in Hastings, six new roll growth classrooms each at Clendon Park School and Rowandale School in Manurewa, replacing fire damaged buildings at Westland High School, a new 10 classroom block at Beachland School in Hinua, the rebuild of Banks Avenue School in Christchurch, and the redevelopment of Hagley College in Christchurch, Maniototo area school in Ranfurly, and Narawahia High School.
Supplementary, sir. What support is the government giving the construction industry on existing school property projects after we went into level four?
Mr. Speaker, the government acknowledges the difficulty some building and construction players found experienced during the COVID level four lockdown. The Ministry of Education's temporary lifting its retention requirements, which releases an extra $23 million earlier in the process to help relieve some of the financial strain construction firms are under. The release will cover 246 projects at 237 schools across the country and will help to ease the cash flow and go some way to reducing the impact of the lockdown on those firms.
Question number three, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What lessons for the New Zealand economy, if any, has he taken from the Australian response to COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Roberts.
Mr. Speaker, it is too early to draw definitive lessons from the economy from either New Zealand or Australia's response to COVID-19. What we can say is that both countries have done a good job of getting the virus under control, which gives both countries the best possible chance for their economies to recover.
Does he accept that one of the key lessons from Australia's approach is that effective contact tracing allows more of the economy to stay to safely open up more quickly, thereby saving jobs?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I think both sides of the Tasman would agree that contact tracing is a very important part of the response to COVID-19. It's certainly a significant one that we've been discussing in this House this week, so it is an important part of the overall response.
Why is a contact tracing app taking so long to develop here?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the member, if he has questions about the contact tracing app, is better off directing those to the Minister of Health, because the Ministry of Health has been responsible for that. We have made significant improvements and strides in our contact tracing over the last little while, and that will continue. But for detailed matters on that, the Minister needs to ask the responsible minister.
I probably should have ruled it out, but...
Does he agree with Prime Minister of Australia Scott Morrison's assessment that New Zealand has imposed, quote, more extreme economic measures?
Speaker, what New Zealand has done is put in place a regime that is appropriate for our country, and I am particularly proud of the response of New Zealanders in general to keeping this virus under control. I think we should focus on what we can do for our people here.
Could he just explain why we are so different to Australians?
Mr. Speaker, I don't quite know where to start. That
well,
size would
it
be
could,
one
could
place.
Be a thesis,
to,
couldn't it,
size is one place to start, but also, as the Prime Minister has just said, the fact is that New Zealand has our own unique population of people with a unique set of circumstances in the way that we live and who that we are, and we have taken decisions that are appropriate for us. I would note, Mr. Speaker, that for example, what New Zealand has done is front-loaded the fiscal stimulus and the fiscal response that we've done. So I think in the year that we're in now, the financial year that we're in now, around 70% of New Zealand's response will be spent, whereas in Australia it's around 33%. So we're making sure that actually we're getting money into the pockets of New Zealanders. The Australian JobKeeper program has not put any money yet into the pockets of Australians. We have $10.6 billion in the pockets of New Zealanders.
Question number four, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
Thank you. My question is to the Minister of Health. Does he agree with statements made by Professor Des Gorman to the Epidemic Response Committee yesterday? And if not, what comments from Professor Gorman does he disagree with?
The Mr. Honourable Speaker, Dr. David Clark.
As the member will understand, as I'm not a member of the committee, I did not see Professor Gorman's submission. I have seen reports of what he said, though, some of which I agree with, such as his comment that there had been chronic underinvestment in public health. I disagree with his view that we were, quote, spectacularly complacent, end quote. The government and New Zealanders have taken this pandemic incredibly seriously. We have gone hard and early, and we have collectively managed to stop community transfer of COVID-19 for now.
Would he agree with Professor Gorman regarding border closure that, quote, we went early but soft, end quote?
Mr. Speaker, no. New Zealand took early action at the border, starting on February the 3rd with restrictions on travel from China. At every step, we took into consideration the best available scientific and health advice. It simply would not have been possible to introduce quarantine for all New Zealanders returning to the country in mid-February. There are not enough hotel rooms in the whole country to handle the volume of people that were returning. Our approach has worked, and I think the results speak for themselves.
Was Professor Gorman's assertion that the current alert level is due, quote, to a lack of confidence in either community surveillance, contact tracing or isolation capacity, end quote, correct? And if so, which one does he lack confidence in?
Mr. Speaker, could the member please repeat the question?
Is Professor Gorman's assertion that we are currently in level 3 because quote, of a lack of confidence in either community surveillance, contact tracing or isolation capacity, end quote, correct? And if so, which one does he lack confidence in?
The Speaker, no.
Well, does he agree with Professor Gorman that the three-day close contact target should be 100% and not 80%?
Mr. Speaker, I'm not quite sure that that is accurate. We are tracking our close contacts very successfully currently, and I think Dr. Verrill has made the right recommendations.
Does he agree that, quote, we've been successful because of high compliance with social distancing, end quote, and not because of our contact tracing? And if so, does he think the government's let the team of 5 million down by not doing its bit soon enough?
Mr. Speaker, in respect of the second part of the question, no. In respect of the first part, I do want to thank New Zealanders for their extraordinary efforts in the lockdown. We have successfully managed to squash community transmission for now, and I think that an extraordinary effort is thanks to the hard work of ordinary and everyday New Zealanders.
Question number five, Chloe Swilbrick.
To the Minister of Education, does the government consider that supporting students and the tertiary education sector is an important part of the response to COVID-19?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, yes. That's why the government moved quickly as a first step to double course-related costs to $2,000 for students to draw down support themselves, as that was the quickest way that we could get additional funding to them. We also moved to ensure that they continue to receive the same level of support over an eight-week study break to buffer any disruption that may be caused by COVID-19. We've provided tertiary education organisations with a guarantee that their 2020 funding will not be impacted by any loss of domestic students as a result of COVID-19. That ensures that $2 billion in committed vote tertiary education funding will continue to be paid. The tertiary education providers are one of the few sectors that have guaranteed funding during the disruption caused by COVID-19. And there are also likely to be increases in enrolments in later this year and in 2021 as a result of the economic effects of COVID-19.
Supplementary. Is the Minister concerned then that some tertiary education institutes are charging rent for accommodation that students are not able to live in?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I am concerned about that, and it is quite a complex situation. In some cases, those accommodation providers are the universities themselves or the tertiary providers themselves. In other cases, they're third-party providers that are contracted to the universities. And then in other cases, they're entirely private operations. So it's quite a complex set of arrangements. The living arrangements themselves are also different. For example, in some cases, students are renting a room in a hostel or a hall of residence. In other cases, they might be renting a room in an apartment. And so it's quite a complex sector. Some of the providers there are accessing the wage subsidy and continuing to charge students their full room rent during that time, which I find utterly unacceptable.
Does he think that more financial support should be provided for students so that they do not need to take on more debt to support themselves through COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, the government is looking at ways that we can provide additional support to students, and we're also asking tertiary providers to also be looking at ways that they can support their student communities through this crisis. And as new opportunities arise to increase the financial support, I'll continue to push for those.
Speaking to new opportunities, does he support NZUSA's call for a universal student allowance?
Mr. Speaker, whilst some members on this side of the House have argued over quite a long period of time for things like a universal student allowance, in the current climate it is really important that we channel additional financial support to the people who need it most in these economic times. And so that's where the government's priority is at this point.
Will then the government invest more in the tertiary education sector and in student support as part of its response to COVID-19, given the importance of training and education and allowing people to take on new career and job opportunities?
Mr Speaker, there is a budget coming up in a very short period of time, but I can indicate to the member that the government is very much focused on ensuring that retraining opportunities and support for those who do need to undertake retraining and upskilling as a result of the economic crisis will be an integral part of the government's response.
The Right Honourable Winston
Peel. Can I ask the Minister, is it a fact that an unparalleled 100-year crisis of the nature that COVID-19 has inflicted upon our economy means that he may be, as Minister of Education, struggling to fund all the demands made of him?
Mr Speaker, that is true, although I'd quite happily fund them all. It's the gentleman to my left who's more of the impediment to that.
Question number six, Chris Bishop.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Minister for Regional Economic Development, does he stand by his policies and statements in relation to regional economic development?
The Right Honourable Winston Pearce.
On behalf of the Minister, I most certainly do, particularly the statement about how the previous National Administration willfully neglected the regions for 9 long years.
Supplementary, has the government sought advice from officials on making changes to the criteria for the Provincial Growth Fund in light of COVID-19? And if so, what did the advice say?
On behalf of the Minister, any sound, wise, sane and experienced Minister would do that facing any crisis, and in a crisis of the nature of COVID-19 meant that we had to refocus our priorities. Most certainly we did, and I cannot believe anyone would rise in this House asking that question.
Supplementary. Well, in light of that answer, what changes to the Provincial Growth Fund criteria have been made by the government?
On behalf of the Minister, just take one. For example, we know that tourism is struggling because, amongst other things, international travel will not be happening. And then we've got health and security issues and a number of things like the factor of units to keep the operations going all around provincial New Zealand where tourism is concerned. So, of course, we're refocusing and repurposing with respect to those initial initiatives where we were supporting tourism. It doesn't mean that they are not going to be supported long-term, but in the short term, right here, right now, we're taking the smart commercial decisions that any wise government would take.
The Honourable Tracy Martin.
To the Minister, is the PGF focused on the aim to drive a revival in manufacturing in New Zealand?
On behalf of the Minister, most certainly. We were a government that came to power with manufacturing in decline, and now one of the great experiences or lessons of the global crisis caused by COVID-19, and it's no use making a lot of silly sounds from Ipsum when the commercial experience that you have as a Member of Parliament is precisely zero. Perhaps that member who wants a shout-out in the House every day could get up and tell the country what commercial experience he's got. And having got none, please keep his mouth shut while someone who's got commercial experience seeks to tell him what we're doing. Now, here's the real purpose. Many, I have. Mr Bridges, I made more money in my law firm than you ever made, right, in 1 month, and you made in 6 months. That's a fact. Now, back to your point. If you want to make a silly challenge like that, I'm up to it. But here's the point. Manufacturing was in decline, and we're going to revive manufacturing because all of a sudden, a whole lot of people realise that a call a long time ago to restore New Zealand manufacturing is now making compelling common sense.
Is the PGF focused on supporting New Zealand businesses to add value in New Zealand to our raw materials?
On behalf of the Minister, that's a brilliant question. Take, for example, sending logs offshore in their most raw, unprocessed state for tens of thousands of jobs for some other economy and 10, 6 to sometimes 20 times the added value offshore. We seek to add value in that product onshore New Zealand first. And all around provincial New Zealand, where forestry is our mainstay, it'll cause an economic and employment and wealth revival. This is common sense. As with all of our primary products, where we can add value, we should add it here and get the top market price, not allow it to go to some other economy. That has always been a wise national strategy.
Parliamentary, Mr.
The
Speaker.
Honourable Dr. Nick Smith.
Does the government support the decision of Air New Zealand, in which it's a 52% shareholder, to close its regional maintenance base in Nelson permanently with the loss of over 100 high-value manufacturing jobs that he seeks to champion?
On behalf of the Minister, what a fascinating question. Given that the construction of the ownership of Air New Zealand was the National Party's policy, not any policy of any party on this side of the House. He would not know that, of course, and that's his level of experience when it comes to commerce as well. But here's the second question. And if he thinks the government is a 52% shareholder today, then he knows nothing about what's just happened. The third thing is Mr. Foran is a leading commercial mind that came to Air New Zealand, and we're prepared to give him a chance to make that airline a great success once again, having been saved for the umpteenth time by the Minister of Finance and the taxpayer.
Supplementary.
I want to ask Dr. Smith just to wait. I know it's sometimes hard to predict. Well, wait until
a good part of the answers are simply abuse.
I'm going to stand up. The member will sit down. And I'm going to require him to wait until the Deputy Prime Minister or the Minister acting for the Minister of Regional Development has finished his answer before he stands up in that way. And if he wants the abuse to stop, I think he should talk to a number of his colleagues who are interjecting in the absolute knowledge that they're going to set that abuse off. Dr. Smith. A point of order, the Honourable Gerry Browning.
Mr. Speaker, I think your somewhat lecturing tone there to the House is unreasonable. There's been a good degree of decorum in here, as reasonable questions have been answered. That was a very reasonable question from Dr. Smith, as were questions earlier today. To be greeted with a barrage of personal insult is, I think, somewhat unbecoming for the nature of the House, particularly at this difficult time, and particularly where you're asking a question that is sensitive to so many New Zealanders who are about to lose their job.
Mr. Speaker, every time I've visited the House, since I've come back in the last day or two, to answer a question, I've been met with a whole lot of hectoring and interjections, and the audience out there in New Zealand should know, about three or four people shouting across the side of the House. Now, I've got a famous line for them, and it's Elvis Presley's famous quote, if you're looking for trouble, you've come to the right place.
Speaking to the point of order,
Stripped of the Hansard, you will find that that member started personal attacks first, and we only responded to his personal attacks.
I think in that particular case, certainly if we take the question time as a whole, as opposed to just that supplementary, that is not accurate. The member answering the question initially responded to a couple of interjections, at least one of which came from that member. In responding to Mr. Brownlee's point of order, I do look forward and I hope that we can have more decorum in the House. I don't think members will find another member with more familial interest in the Air New Zealand redundancies than me. And I just want to make clear, go back to my original point, and that is the normal courtesy of letting members answer their questions before someone stands up, unless they have a point of order, will be the way that we continue to run the House. Mr. Brownlee.
Just not wanting to prolong the point of order, the reply that was given by the Right Honourable Winston Peters was allowed to stand, and I simply want to make it clear to him that the country is in trouble at the moment, and we are not looking for more. We just want answers. And that's not an unreasonable position for an opposition to take when a government has so much leeway, as they have at the present time, to do the extraordinary things that are required of them.
OK, well, I'll deal with that now. The member knows absolutely it's not a point of order, but I think I'll ask the Deputy Prime, the Minister acting for the Minister of Regional Development to take that on. Dr. Smith.
Supplementary, what is his response to the petition to the Minister of Regional Economic Development, signed by over 15,000 people in just a week, seeking that the government's $900 million of financial support to Air New Zealand be tagged to retaining the regional maintenance facility in Nelson and the over 100 high-paying jobs?
On behalf of the Minister, my response is that any opportunity for an intervention like that has been constrained, outlawed and prohibited by the structure the National Party set up in the ownership of Air New Zealand. It deliberate, no, excuse me, if you'll just wait. And Mr Browning wanted an answer. If you deliberately take a minister and a government out of the decision-making power of a business like that, which is what a structure is, and it's unique, as a state-owned enterprise, it's a structure different to any other one, then how can you now intervene? The minister's asked me, as a minister, to step up and do that. That is be a part and parcel of the everyday decision-making process of an airline, whilst the operation legally that they're existing under prohibits the minister from doing anything like that.
A point of order, Mr Browning.
Mr Speaker, that answer demonstrates the problem that I outlined before. We are here just to get answers. To be given a lecture like that is fundamentally wrong, and have that accepted on the Hansard record as being reasonable in this circumstance is not good for the decorum of the House or for the people who are actually wanting to get information from this process. Now, I know in normal times you might get away with a bland answer like that, but it is a fact that in this case it is government ministers who negotiated directly with Air New Zealand the arrangements around the $900 million order, and also made sure it's partly equity-based if they can't meet those payments. To say they have no opportunity to put conditions around a loan or the eventual transfer of equity is plain wrong.
Okay. I think now for the third time the member has made an intervention which may or may not be factually correct, but cannot be characterised as a point of order. Members cannot stand up on a point of order in order to disagree with an answer. And I'm sure the member knows it. The solution for the member, as he is aware, is to ask another supplementary. Dr. Smith.
Has the Minister of Regional Economic Development made any statements publicly or directly to Air New Zealand on the significant loss of over 100 high-value manufacturing jobs from the permanent closure of the regional maintenance facility in Nelson, given his propensity to previously make all sorts of comments about Air New Zealand's business?
On behalf of the Minister, and being aware of that last sarcastic addition to the question, the Minister makes it very clear that unlike any other minister, he has been more profoundly interested in the provincial existence and survival of Air New Zealand services, and still is. But the real point, again, is this. The prescription that it says he cannot get involved in the everyday decision-making was written by the National Party, and to stand up here today and say that we should forget about that when its ownership structure is unique... When its ownership structure is unique.
Point of order, the Honourable Dr. Nick Smith.
Mr Speaker, my question was, had the Minister made any statements publicly?
Order. And we will, the member will resume his seat. We will wait until we get to the end of the member's answer before we prejudge whether he's answered it or not.
Again, the member on behalf of the Minister, the opportunity to make the kind of statement being invited now, no matter how sympathetic as a minister I might be towards what is happening around the provinces, dare say the services of the provinces and the workforce in the provinces where New Zealand is concerned, I am nevertheless constrained by a proscription that was put in place by a previous government, namely the National Government, which, unlike any other SOE, says I cannot do what the member is asking.
Question number 7, Dr. Shane Retty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Health, does he stand by all his statements and actions around coronavirus screening at the border?
The Honourable Dr. David Clark.
Mr. Speaker, in their full context, yes, noting that primary responsibility for border controls sits with the Minister of Customs.
Supplementary. Is the new passenger arrival card with coronavirus questions that he describes in written answers an important border screening tool, and has it screened tens of thousands of arrivals?
Mr Speaker, I don't have the details of that particular customs tool in front of me, but I can advise him that the Ministry of Health certainly had input into it, and collection of that information has been important to our efforts.
Why does the new passenger's arrival card ask about fever, cough and difficulty breathing when written questions show he was advised by ESR that fever, cough and sore throat are the main symptoms?
Obviously, this is a very detailed question in respect of a broader primary question, but what I can tell the member, certainly, and I'd be happy if he wants to put specific questions down to provide further detail, is that the customs screening generally is interested not just in coronavirus. We are, of course, particularly interested in coronavirus right now, but we are also interested in other infectious diseases that might present at the border, and always have been as a country.
Has New Zealand's new passenger arrivals card been asking the wrong symptom screening question, given he was advised in written questions to me 4971 that nearly half of the cases in New Zealand present with a sore throat?
Mr Speaker, at every point we have taken decisions based on the best medical and scientific advice. I can assure the member that there is very thorough screening going on at the airport, and conversations are being had to ensure that we are quarantining where appropriate and putting people into managed self-isolation. A very thorough regime is in place, and I want to take this opportunity to thank all of those at the border who are involved in this effort. It is incredibly important to the success that we have had as a country getting the reproduction rate of that virus right down.
Supplementary. Will he commit to working with ESR to redo the passenger arrival card so that our borders can be better protected?
Mr Speaker, I will commit to the Ministry of Health continuing to work with experts to make sure that all of our systems are optimised. Of course, this virus has been presented a rapidly evolving situation, and along the way we continue to learn more things about it and its presentation. So, of course, naturally, there will be ongoing conversations.
Question number 8, Paul Eagle.
Tēnā koe, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health. How has New Zealand built up its contact tracing capacity?
Mr Speaker, traditionally all contact tracing in New Zealand has been done at a local level by public health units. These units are staffed by highly skilled professionals and they have done a good job. But in the face of COVID-19, it was clear that we needed to ramp up our contact tracing capacity. That led to the establishment of the National Close Contact Service on March the 24th, the first time contact tracing has been centralised and conducted at a national level. The National Service has more than 200 trained staff and can make 5,000 calls per day, which can be scaled up to 10,000 if required. And that is on top of the excellent ongoing work of our public health units.
Supplementary. Has New Zealand now achieved the gold standard for contact tracing?
Mr Speaker, contact tracing is one of the key public health measures we can take to keep COVID-19 at bay. The government has invested a total of $70 million to strengthen and expand our contact tracing, which is now operating on a dedicated information technology platform, the National Contact Tracing Solution. Mr Speaker, the Director General of Health has assured New Zealanders that our contact tracing is now gold standard.
Supplementary. What has been done to ensure our contact tracing continues to be fit for purpose?
Members, as members will be aware, Otago University's Dr. Aisha Verrill conducted a rapid audit of contact tracing. Work is underway to implement all of her recommendations. Yesterday, appointments were also finalised for a Section 11 committee to advise me on our progress. That committee will be chaired by Sir Brian Roche, with members Dr Philip Hill, Warren Moitara, Dr Marion Poor and Liz Reid. Mr Speaker, I want to thank Sir Brian and his team for agreeing to take on this important task.
Question number 9, Nicola Willis.
My question is to the Minister of Education and asks, will guidance be available for early learning services about how they will be expected to operate under COVID-19 Alert Level 2? If so, when will that advice be available?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr Speaker, as I said yesterday, guidance for the shift from Alert Level 3 to Alert Level 2 has already been published. This was consulted on with the sector before it was sent out. The Ministry of Education has continued to have regular meetings with individual providers as they normally would do, and representative bodies, and more detailed guidance will be disseminated around the middle of next week.
Supplementary. Will parents be able to safely return their children to normal hours of early childhood education attendance at Alert Level 2?
Mr Speaker, what I can speak to is the very high-level principles that were set out in the government's alert level framework, and people can find that on covid19.govt.nz. And that envisages that schools and early learning services will be reopened more or less completely at alert level 2, with some exceptions. For those who are at high risk, there will still be some provisions to support them to learn from home using distance learning and to support learning from home where their school and early childhood staff. And further information, of course, is going to be released in due course.
Supplementary. What guidelines is the government considering to ensure early childhood services can operate safely with full attendance at Alert Level 2?
Mr Speaker, the Ministry of Education has been working very closely with the Ministry of Health and regional public health officials in particular, alongside the sector leadership in early childhood education, to ensure that both the guidelines are clear and that services have any additional support that they need in order to be able to operate at Alert Level 2.
Supplementary. Does he think any early childhood education services will close as a result of COVID-19 related enrolment and financial pressure?
Mr Speaker, no, I don't think it'll be directly as a result of COVID-19, because the government is continuing to provide the full subsidies for those services, even where they only have one or two or even no children attending those early childhood services. Where their parent revenue, the fees charged to parents, makes up more than 30% of their income, they have been eligible to apply for the wage subsidy, and several of those services have already done so. So I don't think that that will be the reason for some services experiencing financial difficulty. I do want to acknowledge, though, that even before COVID-19, there were some small community-based early childhood services that have been experiencing financial difficulties, and that the COVID-19 situation has simply brought that into even starker relief.
Question number 10, Matt Ducey.
Thank you very much, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health and asks, why, as of February 2020, has the government only spent $3.2 million of the promised $455 million announced in Budget 2019 for a new frontline mental health service? And why, in the recent re-announcement of $40 million for this new frontline mental health service, was the rollout not expected to be completed until the middle of 2021?
The Honourable Dr David Clark.
Mr Speaker, in answer to the first part of the question, the total investment of $455 million is for a national rollout over 4 years, and that rollout will continue thereafter. A total of $25 million has been allocated to service delivery in 2019-20, and $3.2 million distributed to providers as at February 2020, the member refers to, relates to sustaining the 22 previously pilot sites providing services through general practice and continuation of other existing primary mental health and addiction supports. I'd also note that this government has also funded other new initiatives, including Mana Ake, which has helped around 5,000 primary and intermediate age children in Canterbury and Kaikoura, and Piki, which is providing mental health support for 18 to 24-year-olds in Wellington and Wairarapa, which is not to mention nurses in schools across the country. We've also put more into acute services, mental health, alcohol and drugs support, building new mental health facilities. And in answer to the second part of the member's question, it was not a re-announcement. These are new contracts we're announcing for new services that will serve a population of 1.5 million once it is fully rolled out. It does take time to train new workforces and establish new services.
Entry question. Thank you, Mr Speaker. Supplementary to the Minister, Why is the Minister using the excuse of available workforce when NZAC accredited primary care counsellors contracted to DHBs are being told there is no funding available to respond to the growing demand of mental health referrals as a result of the impacts of COVID-19?
Mr Speaker, what I would say is that, first off, I want to thank those who are working in this response because they've been working tirelessly through COVID-19. A number of additional access points have been set up, and that includes, of course, the Mentimeter app, the 35,000 downloads in just 10 days. Mellon, which is online resource that's being supervised by councillors. Sparklers at Home, 48,000 people have accessed that uniquely in a month. Wise Group has stood up an app. So these responses are there to support New Zealanders' immediate needs in response to COVID-19. And the government has already allocated an additional $15 million to support the psychosocial wellbeing of New Zealanders during this outbreak. So, Mr Speaker, in terms of a specific issue the member might be raising, a specific instance, I'd be happy to hear more from him if he wants to put a question down in writing.
Hopeless. Supplementary question to the Minister. Is the Minister's new frontline mental health service, announced in 2019, but only to be partially rolled out by the middle of 2021, 14 months away, too late for the many people described by New Zealand Medical Association Chair, Dr. Kim Baddock, at the Epidemic Response Committee last week, when she said her colleagues have seen a huge increase in the amount of mental issues they are facing?
Mr Speaker, I would refer to some of those things I've mentioned in my previous answer. The uptake of those services has been extraordinary in a short period of time, and I think bears witness to the appropriateness of them rolling out during the COVID period. I'd also note that the 1737 number has helped tens of thousands of New Zealanders this year and has had scaled up significantly. So the government has responded quite specifically to the situation we find ourselves in. I would also note that already 18,000 free sessions have been delivered to New Zealanders by this new frontline service. Many of those people might not have received the support in a timely fashion without this new service. And we're rolling it out nationwide. By the middle of next year, a population of 1.5 million people will have access to a new service at their local GP for free. And this service was simply not available previously. The demand for mental health services had nearly doubled, or perhaps over-doubled in a decade, and the support for services had only gone up by around half the amount needed. So introducing this new free service for Kiwis is something that is timely, and I believe the uptake rates of these services indicate that they are providing a unique and important service for New Zealanders that was not previously available.
Supplementary. To the Minister, why is the Minister saying that there is more funding available for mental health services when at the recent DHB annual reviews, DHB representatives said they couldn't point to where the money is exactly and they think the $1.9 billion hasn't flowed out yet?
Mr Speaker, I can't answer for those unnamed representatives the member speaks of, but what I would say is, of course, that the DHBs received over 200 million more in the ring-fenced mental health fund. So 200 million is certainly not nothing, and that's in their annual budget. And they received 200 million more the year before as well. So on average, I think it's 103 million more per annum has gone into DHB specifically for mental health, off the top of my head, on top of the 1.3 billion, which of course is being rolled out over a 4 or 5 year period. So the member will of course know that our record as a country is of underinvestment in this area. I'm very proud to be a part of a government that is for the first time taking mental health seriously.
Which of the following statements does he consider most correct? The New Zealand Association of Councillors President Christine McFarlane, who said the government's latest mental health announcement is a total waste of taxpayers' money, or following the Minister's interview on his announcement on Saturday, News Hub Nation reporter Simon Shepherd saying this has got a slight Kiwi build flavour about it?
Mr Speaker, I disagree with the first comment, and I certainly haven't seen the second.
Question number 11, Kira Tapu Allen.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Revenue. What recent tax measures, if any, has he announced to support businesses affected by COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker.
Honourable Stuart Nash.
Mr. Speaker, the last time I was in this House, we announced...
Tidy your shirt up, will you? You have collar. Thank you.
It's been 5 weeks since I've had to wear a tie, Mr. Speaker. The last time I was in this House, we announced a $2.8 billion business tax package to help cushion New Zealanders from the worst economic impacts of the COVID-19 outbreak. We restored restored depreciation deductions from commercial buildings, increased the provisional tax threshold to relieve the compliance burden for small businesses, and allowed the immediate write-off for low-value assets. These measures are now law. Since then, we've also announced a $3.1 billion tax loss carryback scheme and changed the rules to the loss continuity regime. That provides an estimated $60 million in annual savings to business. Mr. Speaker, this package delivers the single biggest government support package to businesses via the tax system in modern New Zealand history.
Supplementary, then. How does the loss carryback scheme help support businesses affected by COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, the loss carryback scheme means that businesses will get a refund from some of the tax paid in the previous year. The changes mean tax could start flowing to businesses via the tax system as early as next week. Tax refunds will be a cash lifeline for businesses with non-wage fixed costs like rent, interest and insurance. Some don't want to take on extra debt with a bank loan. Without the support, these otherwise viable SMEs may be forced to close. Many small and medium businesses are feeling the pain now. We are moving urgently to get tax into their hands as quickly as possible. As the Prime Minister and the Minister of Finance have said, we are constantly monitoring the situation for businesses and adjusting our support as required.
What responses has he seen in reaction to the loss carryback scheme?
Mr. Speaker, overall this policy has been positively received. The loss carryback scheme, quote, provides significant cash support to businesses that can be accessed relatively quickly, end quote, says John Cuthbertson of Chartered Accountants Australia New Zealand. Kirk Hope, Business New Zealand, says the loss carryback scheme, quote, will be a significant help for many firms, end quote, cash flow problems. MYOB New Zealand Country Manager Ingrid Cronin-Knight said many smaller local businesses are staring down the barrel of a loss this year, and the government scheme could make a difference, and I quote, the ability to offset a forecast loss in the current year against the previous year's tax will give them more options to reduce cost and free up cash, end quote. This is an unprecedented global event, Mr. Brownlee, and will have a significant impact on our economy. We are pulling out all stops to protect the health of New Zealanders and the health of the economy.
Question number 12, Andrew Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Building Construction. Does she expect builders and their apprentices can fully resume work as lockdown restrictions are lifted?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Chris Farfoy.
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Building and Construction, the Government has been working for some time to minimise the impact of COVID-19 and its economic consequences on construction firms and workers. We've been working to ensure people can return to work as promptly and safely as possible. Construction Health and Safety New Zealand, in conjunction with the Joint Government and Industry Construction Sector Accord, published detailed construction health and safety standards and protocols to help develop a control plan. Mr. Speaker, while everyone wants to get back to a work site, we must do it safely. A return to a higher alert level is the worst case scenario for the industry and our economy. Anyone wanting more information on those protocols can visit building.govt.nz, where a full range of advice is available to them on how to operate under alert levels 3, 2 and 1.
Supplementary. Does she have an estimate of how many of the 250,000 builders and apprentices are currently back at work?
Mr. Speaker, I don't have, on behalf of the Minister, I don't have that number on me at the moment. But as I said, some clear guidelines were given to the construction sector over a week ago in order to ensure that they could return to work sites safely at level 3. My understanding of the situation is because of issues like social distancing on building work sites, that that would in some cases mean that not everyone who would normally be on a work site could, to ensure the safety of those people on the work site. But hopefully if New Zealand pulls together through level 3, we can ensure more people can get back to building sites in order to work safely and continue economic activity.
Supplementary. Does she agree with the reports I've been receiving from the building industry that a large number of the 25,000 building apprentices will be laid off before the end of the year?
Good question. Mr Speaker, I've seen media reports to that effect, and all I could say to that, Mr Speaker, is that I think it is too early to tell exactly what those numbers might be. As has been mentioned by many ministers, as the House has resumed, there is going to be an economic impact across all sectors. Exactly what that is at this stage is hard to tell, but the government is absolutely focused on making sure that we can protect every job that we can possible. But we have said that is obviously, we have said from the outset that it is going to be difficult to save every job. One thing that we do want to make sure we can do, and other ministers are working on this issue, especially in relation to apprentices, is making sure that we make a commitment to upskilling and retraining people if they find themselves out of work and in need of a new career.
Supplementary. What reports has she seen on the number of building consents that could have been processed during the 5-week lockdown but weren't and are still outstanding?
Mr Speaker, I don't have that number on me. On behalf of the Minister, I don't have that number on me at the moment, but I'm happy for the Member to submit that as a written question. Obviously, Mr Speaker, economic activity has slowed down as a result of being in lockdown for the last 5 to 6 weeks, and I would expect that a number like that would have reduced.
That concludes oral questions.